like I worked in ecological landscaping for a long time, and I feel like what I've learned from this unschooling journey is really similar to what I have experienced with the idea of landscaping or ecological conservation kind of stuff. Is like we force everything. Like we force it. We want to create a container, and then we want to like design how everything's going to function within the container, and then we like want that to work. So like that could be school, that could be public school, that could be homeschool, right?
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hello, I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Untaming podcast. Today it is the full hunger moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. When this episode airs, we will be literally moving onto our new land. If you have been listening to this podcast from the beginning, you'll know this is something we've been looking for a long time, and we're all very excited that it's finally happening. Once I get a chance, I'll probably get around to sharing some photos of our land on social media. So if you follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook, you'll probably get a chance to see what it's like. I hope you enjoyed the last episode with Ainsley Rowan. I love that we were able to cover a range of topics from movements for parents to eye development to postpartum. The next episode to come out on the last quarter of the Hunger Moon is with Tracy Castles. Tracy has a PhD in developmental psychology, and she is also the director of Evolutionary Parenting. Her interview was recorded by our guest host, Mary Fransell. But today we have Natasha Tucker here, and I have to apologise. I had a cold at the time that we recorded the interview, so my voice was a bit husky, as it still is now. Fortunately, you're not here to listen to me. You're here to hear what Natasha has to say. Enjoy. A 39-year-old Natasha Tucker was born in Lancaster County, where she currently lives with her husband Kevin and two of their four children ranging in ages from 9 to 11. Natasha has studied ecology and the natural world extensively and co-owned an eco-friendly landscaping and gardening company for a number of years. She also worked as a teacher in the Waldorf school system for some time with kindergarten-age children. Some other previous work of hers includes the Year of Black Clothing Project, which was an exploration of grief and rebellion, and her novella Liminal, which was published by Black and Green Press in 2014. Currently, Natasha is working as an herbalist, teaching and writing full-time. She and her husband, Kevin, are co-hosts of the Primal Anarchy podcast. Last night, she had 6.5 hours of sleep, and for dinner tonight, she had a chicken salad with mozzarella cheese and tomato, a scone, and a cup of water. Natasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Emily. I'm so happy to be here. That was a really lovely introduction.
So when I first contacted you about doing this interview, we both felt like we already kind of knew each other, even though we never actually talked before. And it's already taken us like 40 minutes to actually start this interview because we've been chatting so much. Just from, you know, listening to each other's podcasts and following each other online. But as I said in your introduction, you've written the novella Liminal, and you're also working on a larger book called Rites of Passage. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like a good way for the listeners to get to know you would be if you told us about Liminal.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So Liminal is a teeny tiny little book, and it's currently out of print. Kevin and I are working on trying to figure out like how to put that out again. Although it is available to listen to as an audiobook. Which is actually, I'm already on a tangent, but a guy named Ryan Morgan from a really great band called Misery Signals ended up reading the story for the audiobook, and he did such an incredible job.
That's cool.
So anyway, that's all right. I'm already off course here, but so liminal. When I have always liked writing, and I have always been able to write, like as far as like papers or you know, reports or whatever. But I basically started writing in like what I usually describe as like for my survival after my son was born, and he turns 10 in September. So actually this is a really nice time to reflect on this. Liminal actually ended up coming out of the Year of Black clothing project. His birthday is September 20th. And I think it was the same month. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was the same month I decided to start a blog. I knew that I had a lot to explore, like a lot of feelings to explore. And I knew that one way that I could effectively do that for myself was through writing. And like blogs were kind of like they were like the thing at that time.
Yeah.
So, and I had enjoyed journaling previously, particularly nature journaling. So anyway, I decided to start a blog, but I knew that what I wanted to explore was like these really intense, like very like hard to explore feelings of like grief and sorrow, but like more than just like I felt like if I could describe what I felt like in that time when I was pregnant and when he was coming earthside, is like I would picture just this feeling of like these like vines of like grief and sorrow, like literally like wrapped around my heart. Like I just felt like I was in this like cage of sadness. And right before that time, like my ex-husband and I had gone through a period of like pretty intense like organizing and activism, which was like a really beautiful time for me. But there was so much that like I hadn't explored emotionally, or like really looked at as far as like my relationship with the natural world and like how I felt about living I consider it like collapsing ecosystems, so like what it's like to like be so in love with the natural world, but like basically there's destruction like all around us. And I hadn't looked at any of these things. So, like, I had been immersed in this idea of, like, protecting the world, protecting the natural world, protecting, like, all these things that I love and care about. But I hadn't literally, like, not even given an eyeball to, like, the feelings of grief that come along with loving something so much that's, like, endangered, right? So, and I probably could have kept going like that, except then I got pregnant with Revel. Then I was like, it was just like too much. Like for me, pregnancy was like really like an emotional sort of like spiritual experience. Like I could absolutely like feel this little new person with me. And I was like, oh my God, like I'm so excited for this. Like I had always wanted to be a mom, and my ex-partner and I had been together for like a decade before we got pregnant with him. So like it was a long time. And we did plan it, so like we deliberately decided to bring a child into the world. And then of course, like once I was pregnant, I was just like, oh my God, like what have I done? Like there's a literal brand new life swimming around inside of my body. And like what am I doing? Because like these two things crashed into each other, like the environmental activism and the social activism and bringing the new life in. So, so then once he was born, I decided that I had to like look at it. Like I couldn't just keep going, you know, acting like everything was fine, because like nothing was fine, right? Like all of a sudden I was like, nothing is fine. So I started the blog, and I just kind of like decided, like, from my heart that I wanted to write every day, and that, like, I knew from studying some indigenous cultures and just even, like, traditional communities and cultures that, like, many different cultures around the world, I mean, you could really say all intact cultures around the world, they have some kind of, like, understanding of mourning and grief and how important that is for, like, working through loss or, like, understanding our relationships or, I mean, it like, the understanding of grief and mourning does so much, like, within a culture. But I felt like, especially in this Western culture, like, that understanding of what that even means, like, what do we do with all of this sadness that we feel? Like, I just felt like I just felt like there wasn't a good paradigm at the time. And this was 10 years ago. So honestly, like, things have changed quite a bit since then. But it's just like, I have to, like, throw myself into this. And I knew that I was, like, deeply, like, in a grief, even as I was, like, so in love with this little baby that I, you know, had just birthed into the world. So I decided, I was just like, I'm like, I'm just gonna, like, do it. Like, I'm just gonna start my mourning period. Cause, like, that is what other cultures do, you know? And here, yeah. I was like, so I don't know, maybe that's cultural appropriation, but I was like, I'm gonna look, I don't have a map here. Like, I'm just gonna, like, sort of look at what other people do and just, like, randomly do it. Like, I'm not saying it was, like, the greatest idea ever. I was just like, this is, like, my way that I'm gonna do this. So I was like, I'm gonna wear black every day, and I'm going to, like, say that this is my, I'm gonna say to the world and to myself and to my family, I am in mourning. Like, this is my period of mourning. And then I'm gonna write about my experience. So that was, like, a very, that ended up being, like, a very transformative project for me. And the blog is still up, and I, you know, I have been really toying with where I want to start, like, more of a daily writing practice where, like, I can share it with people again. And I have thought of maybe just going back to writing on that blog. I don't know. That's sort of, like, a tangent as well. But so as I went through that process of writing on the blog, you know, people would reach out. Like, it ended up gaining some momentum, and I met a lot of people who felt similarly to the way that I did, that just, like, absolutely, you get to this point where, like, we would talk about rewilding and we would talk about reconnecting, and we would be, like, so serious. I spent so much of my early adulthood, like, so serious about giving myself, like, the space and the tools to reconnect to the earth, to the natural world. And then, you know, we'd, like, talk about it to other people, and we'd teach about it, and I'd write about it. And then there was, like, no, you just, I feel like eventually you hit this wall where you're just like, oh my God, like, this is so heavy. Like, the climate is changing, you know, every ecosystem, no matter where you're from, every ecosystem, you can see the effects of, you know, humans' habits. Anyway, a lot of people reached out, and they said, you know, I've absolutely, like, reached this place, or, like, I'm in this place now and I don't know what to do about it. And that was really healing, and it did teach me a lot about like, how important it is to that grieving and mourning is, like, something that happens not necessarily in a solitary way, but that there's something very important about being able to, like, express those feelings with other people who feel the same way. So when I, like, as I was working through those, you know, kinds of emotions in myself, then Liminal sort of became, like, an offshoot of those feelings, because I knew that I wanted to sort of, like, tell a story about what it felt like to be, like, in that early motherhood stage. But, like, I just wanted to explore those, all those, like, edgy feelings I was having. Like, I'm so in love, and I'm, like, so wrecked by this. And, like, it's just, like, it was such an intense time. So then I just, the story, like, came to me, Like, literally, I just, like, thought of the first line, and then I thought of the last line, and then, like, all I had to do was say that. The dots. And so Liminal is a story of a mother, like a woman. She's a woman and she's a mother. Her baby is like, it's between the sort of like 0 to 2 in her child's life. And she, like, long story short, in a nutshell, she, I don't know how to say about this. I don't want to, like, spoiler alert it.
Yeah.
it's about a mother who's, like, a totally, like, in this, like, fiery moment of having to, like, love her baby, but also she has to make this, like, ultimate sacrifice kind of idea for the natural world, or, like, she feels like she has to do this. Mm. And, like, in the story, like, she, I guess, like, now, too, like, 10 years later, I can say, like, that whole process for me, like, the Year of Black Clothing and then Liminal was really be, like, exploring feelings of fear. Like, I don't know that I would have been able to, like, name it that at that time, but, like, fear that, like, we all have fears that we're going to, like, lose the people that we love. Like, I think as parents, like, as soon as that little person comes, you're, like, immediately terrified you're going to lose them. Like, you're immediately, it's just these two sides of the same coin. Like,
yeah,
like, you can almost feel that grief there. And, like, every so often you'll come across, like, a parent who's lost a child, and still to this day, you're just like my kids are 10 and 12 and you're like, I can't even, like, look at that. Like, that's so, and, like, my heart goes out to everybody who's lost a child, because it's like, you're immediately just terrified. And then I feel like the way that I felt about Rebel, like, that's also the way I think, like, now, like I said, I can reflect and say, like, oh, I was feeling, like, intense fear about the state of the natural world, and, like, my relationship with it. But, like, I wouldn't have been able to name it fear 10 years ago, but, like, now I can give it that name. And it's terrifying. I mean, it's terrifying to be in love with something, like, so deeply, and just, like, also absolutely know that, and I don't know what the word is, but I struggle, like, I don't want to say, like, it's dying, but, like, we know we're making drastic changes that are now irreversible. So, like, it's changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And change is terrifying. And especially when you love something very deeply, like, change is even more terrifying. You know, we experience that in our personal relationships. Like, you know, I'm sure everybody's had somebody say to them, like, you've changed. And you're like, yeah, I have. But, like, it's just always scary, right? So, but Liminal was, like, 100% to this day stands as, like, me exploring, like, some really deep fears that I feel like a lot of us carry. And it, again, that book allowed me to, like, connect with other people who felt the same way. And I think out of everything, like, out of all the writing or any of the work that I do, like, being able to connect with other people who are, like, in that same space and are able to, like, say these things out loud, like, it makes me feel less like lonely. It's lonely to be scared. It's lonely to be sad. And then there's something really powerful about the connection with other people around that.
That's good. So now I can't help wondering if the main character, because you said you wrote this not long after your son was born. So yeah, I can't help wondering if the main character is loosely based on yourself and your own perspective.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, like, in some ways, yes. In some ways, tons of that book is just, like, straight lifted from my own experience. But here's a secret about all of the stories that I'll ever write. They're always lifted from my own experience, because I feel very, like, my relationship with writing is that Like, I feel that I can only, and in life, like, I feel very strongly that I can only speak from my own experience. Like, I don't claim to, like, have answers, and I don't claim to, like, be an expert. All I can say to you is, like, I will tell you what worked for me, or, like, I'll tell you what my experience was with that. So I think that I just apply that to writing as well, and a lot of it does come from my personal experiences. So, like, absolutely some of the character is me, and then some of the character just, like, comes from wherever characters come from. And, like, for me, that feels like I always say that for me, writing feels like I'm just, like I have a little magic net, and then I'm just sort of, like it's like how you would catch lightning bugs with a little net. Like, you just sort of are, like, catching them, and then I just sort of, like I, like, pat them down on the paper, and then I, like, hope that they stay there all right together. And then, so it's, like, kind of like that for me. So, like, yes, she's, like, yes, she is me, and yes, she is not me.
Yeah. No, I get that. Now, what about your forthcoming book, Rites of Passage? Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, definitely. So, Rites of Passage has a lot to do with me losing my mom. So, I lost my mom 4 years ago. She battled cancer for about 5 years. So, in the the exact time when, so, like, if we use Revel's life as a timeline here, like, Revel was a baby to, like, maybe 2 or 3 in the time that I was doing the Year of Black Clothing and then wrote Liminal. And then somewhere right around there, my mom, like, when he was quite little, she had her first bout with cancer. So then mostly by when he was little and I was, like, taking care of him and also taking care of my nephew, like, she was sick at the same time. So, and we were very close. We spent a lot of time together. We spent, all our time together. And I was very, very, very fortunate to have the relationship that I had with my mother when the children were little, because, they and I did get to experience sort of what it feels like to, like, have more of an intact community where you have, like, people of varying ages around you that love you and can help you through the difficult moments. Like, that is very lucky. I know that I'm very lucky to have had that. But she was sick during the same years that they were little. So it's hard not to be like, why did that have to happen at that time? And why did we lose her so early? Because I was only 35 when she passed away. But so Rites of Passage is, like, exploring a lot of my feelings around that particular loss, and sort of what that feels like in my life to go from being, like, daughter to, like, and I don't have a large family, and my grandmas have all passed away as well. So, like, it feels very strange to be, like, without that layer of mothering, like, over me, you know what I mean? So it's exploring that a lot. Like, what does that mean? Like, who am I now? Who are we as we, like, as the cycles go past, you know, as we're in these cycles and those changes happen, like, what does that mean for us? So part of it is some short stories. And then part of it is poetry, because I really love writing poetry, and that's actually one of my, like, main forms of expression. And then part of it is some, like, journal entries and nonfiction that I wrote, like, while she was ill and passing away. So I have been working at it for a while, and I have sort of, like, put it on the shelf, like, just short of finishing it a couple of times. And I think, honestly, I just, like, wasn't ready. Like, it's kind of, like, an intense subject matter. And I have noticed that, like now here at year 4, after losing her, like, this is the first year I can like look through her things, and this is the first year I can like listen to old messages from her. And like, I honestly think before now it was just like too intense. Like, I wouldn't have wanted to be like sitting around talking about this subject. So it's like, it's worked out the way that it has needed to work out, but I do feel very ready to like put that, to like send that baby and those feelings out into the world. And then I think too, that's like very cathartic for the person who's like written the thing, like, especially, I mean, I know it is for me, like, that's a very cathartic feeling of like writing all that down and then being able to just like, you like get this little, you get a little book like that like contains the experiences of that time. Like, that is really like, works really well for me emotionally.
No, I get that. That is cool. Because when I initially heard about your book, the title, Rites of Passage, I thought it was a look of various rites of passage throughout life in different cultures. But so it's actually like a look at the rites of passage we experience in our domesticated world. Like, for example, the grief you experience with the loss of your mother. And then from another angle, reaching that point of similar to liminal, like seeing how destructive civilization is and then coping with the existential crisis that kind of beholds. So am I getting this?
Yes, I feel like that's perfect. Like, I think you could say like the idea of rites of passage and like my understanding of what I've experienced as far as like, say, becoming a mother and like losing my mother, like, I know that those fit into sort of like these archetypes of experiences and rites of passage that humans go through, and honestly probably you could say probably every species on the planet goes through, like, so like I do have an understanding of that, and I honestly feel like that's helped me in moments that have been difficult, like in those moments where your life shifts or like your personality shifts or whatever it is that's happening to you. Like, if we have an understanding that those are sort of like inbuilt into our experience, like here as humans, it does help a little bit to know that, like, we're going to go through these difficult times and we're going to come out the other side. But I still feel like our understanding and our like framework for supporting each other or supporting one another in those moments is still very like lacking in Western culture. So I think because I feel so much that I like to speak from my own experience, I think like I often think of like my writing as just like reaching out a hand. Like, instead of me writing a book about rites of passage, like, I'm going to tell you what it felt like when I went through this moment in my own life and was like absolutely like wrecked, and like, here I am, like, here's a hand if you want it, you know, that kind of idea.
Right. Now I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or suggestions or examples, I don't know, on ways to help people manage their grief, because I guess in our domesticated society we don't really allow much space for that. And that's why I love that you did your year of the black clothing. For like an entire year you were in mourning. So yeah, I wondered if you could have like grief, whether that's grief for a parent or it's grief for say somebody who's experienced a miscarriage or other examples of grief that you people experience in their life is a rite of passage.
Yeah. So the question is like, what do I like, frame the question again?
Yeah. I haven't really like set a good question there. I guess from your understanding of what you've read about other cultures, but then I don't want to be like cultural appropriating, like what are some better ways we could be managing our grief?
Okay. Yeah. So it was interesting because when I was thinking about this conversation, I was like, a few years ago, I would have said a list of like all the things that I had read about what cultures do when they're grieving. Mm-hmm. And like, I can still touch on sort of like there's always like themes, right? Because we're all part of the same species and we have like sort of like a fiber that is the same in all of us, like, a lot of cultures, you see the same things repeated in different cultures. So I can touch on those things, but like, like now today, what my answer is I can't speak for other cultures.
Yeah.
So, but I can speak for my own experience, and my own experience is based on my own experience and things that I had researched or experienced, right? So like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So some of the factors that like I was interested in exploring that you find in other cultures, like in a repeated way, when I started the Year of Black Clothing, was this idea of like community grief and mourning that like it's understood in many cultures that there is something like useful and powerful and healing about experiencing a trauma and then recognizing that as a group and expressing the feelings around that trauma. And like now psychology is really supporting a lot of those tradition. Of course, now finally psychology is like supporting a lot of the, I would say, like we could say like indigenous wisdom maybe around around trauma. And you know, that's very, very much like in like popular culture, like we are starting to have a better understanding of trauma. But, and they find this too with just anybody who experiences a traumatic event where they would probably end up with something like PTSD, is that if you experience trauma but you're able to express what you experienced and then also are like sort of held in that by other people. So witness, you could use the word like witnessed, right? Like maybe you've experienced a trauma, but other people are there to help you. Like they witness, they're like, we know you've gone through this. Like they believe you, they are there for you. Like there's a community element in recovering from trauma that like other cultures and indigenous wisdom understands that Western culture is like totally left by the wayside, because like so often we're just supposed to like grin and bear it and keep going and not talk about how we're feeling. Although I do feel like things are getting better in that regard, honestly. I totally forgot like what we were saying about this. this question eludes me. Oh
yeah.
Right. So talking about other cultures. So that was one thing that I really wanted to like sort of like explore, is the idea that there is something about grief that can be held by a community that maybe offers some other kind of healing process than what happens if you experience trauma and are in an isolated situation. I was curious about like if you dedicate a certain time. So like I will speak on the Jewish, I will just speak like a very, very briefly on Jewish tradition, because Kevin is Jewish. So, but I'm like not trying to say that I'm an expert here. Is that, so like say that Jewish tradition is that you like set aside a certain period for grief and mourning, and the people around you and in your life and in your community recognize that you are in mourning during that period of time, and that you will not be expected to like take care of your children and do the dishes and make the bed and like all the normal things that keep life going. Like they recognize that that person will not be doing those things during their set period of mourning. So then I was really interested in those ideas too, is like, okay, well, in cultures where people set aside a particular amount of time, like, is it possible then that that is useful in some way? Like, if, say, I was to set aside a year and, like, fully dedicate, like, I mean, not to that extent. Like, obviously, I was still, like, had to keep life going. But
yeah.
If I set aside that time and just really let myself, like, feel that, like, and I did. I just, like, I would write and I would cry, and I did a lot of research during that time on just like environmental factors and the history of this area and colonization. And like if we we're able to give ourselves over to like that huge feeling that is like that type of sadness and grief, like could we put a finite time on it? So like on the, at the end of that, like would I feel better? Or like, could I put it away? If I said, you know, this period of time, I'm going to give myself to this and then I'm going to be done with it. And like, I feel like my hypothesis in the beginning, because there are cultures that like put a finite time, but I'm not from one of those cultures. Like I don't claim to be from one of those cultures. So I had no experience with that. Like it turns out like, no, there is no finite. I mean, for me anyway, there is no finite ending on that type of grief. And I, was like disappointed. Like, that's like, so like ridiculous to say, but like to this day, I'm like deeply disappointed that the process of grief and mourning is not more tidy. Like it's not a tidy thing. And I did this whole thing and I like gave myself over to the sadness and I like, and I do think that I healed in a lot of ways during that process, but I was still, it didn't alleviate it. It didn't alleviate it to this day. It will never, I mean, I hate to be like a sad Nancy or something, but like, it's not gonna, it can't go away. It's not gonna go away. Like if you feel grief and sadness about what's happening in our environment and our, and in the natural world and in these wild spaces that we love, like that feeling isn't going to alleviate, and that feeling is what needs to drive us forward to do something.
Yeah. That's a good like segue into the next question, which is like along those same lines of viewing civilization as destructive, and then with your perspective as a mother, what thoughts do you have for how to take down civilization?
what a good one, what a big one.
Yeah.
I go around on this like quite a lot, and mostly where what I end up thinking and feeling and saying is that it takes everything. So like it is taking everything and it's going to take everything to make any kind of difference or like scratch on the surface of civilization at all. At the same time, like it is running itself off of a cliff. Like what happens to civilizations or to cultures like ours that are so exploitative is that eventually it gets too out of balance and either like people help topple it or it starts to fall on its own, which I, you know, people feel different ways and varying degrees of like where we are in that process right now. I feel like it is, that is happening. I think it's like a, probably like a much longer process than any of us who love the natural world would hope it to be, because like the longer we keep going this way, the kind of worse things are for the planet. But I think it takes everything. Like I think it's going to take like natural rise and fall of aggressive and violent civilizations, oppressive civilizations. There's like a natural ebb and flow there. I think it's going to take, individuals like you and I, or anybody who's listening to this. I think we have to, and a lot of people are saying this right now, is just like build our local communities and networks, so that we have something outside of the status quo, that we have something outside of the civilized framework of our culture. So like we can resist, but like we also have to have something else to be in. Like we can't just resist, right? So it is exciting, because a lot of people are just like so actively working on building communities based around mutual aid and taking care of one another and taking care of, you know, wild spaces like in their own local area, just like cooking for each other, giving each other money when they need it, and like Like, we have to do that. We have to do that. Nobody's coming to save us. No one is going to help us. Like, we are going to help ourselves and we are going to help each other. So, like, that feels like really important work right now. And then, but that's like not going to do it either. Then we also have to do something to try to push it off the cliff, you know, faster, because like I said, like the longer that we go on like this, the worse it is for the planet. So then, you know, some people or all of us maybe in some way have to be willing to like do some things. So, like, very vague, like I'm going to say very vaguely, like do some things to push things along, or that sort of idea. Like, we're there has to be some understanding of like how the infrastructure actually works and like what you would do if you wanted to adjust it, let's say.
And then, adjust it.
but then the other huge problem is too, like a lot of what we can actually do, or like a lot of what we can affect is like vastly and grossly outside of the hands of the individual, because it comes down to a few very powerful people and very rich people and very powerful corporations, are actually responsible for a great deal of like what we're seeing in our climate and environment today. So, but then those people, I mean, obviously, like, I don't think this is like a crazy thing to say, like those people would I don't think this is like outlandish thing to say. It's like those people who are responsible, like, would have to be taken to task in some way. And like, I don't know what that means, but like, we do know who they are. So yeah. I feel like, I honestly feel like we're to a point with this where like those of us who are like, something has to change. What are we going to do? And there are growing numbers of those of us who feel this way. Like, we actually do know what to do at this point. But like, now it's almost like we're at a precipice where it's like, okay, but like, who's going to do it first? Like, now what? Like, what's going to happen now? Because we're like, oh, we're done with this whole paradigm. Like, I'm so done with this paradigm. I'm sure you're done with this paradigm. Like, we're just, it's done. Like, we're over. We're over it.
Yeah.
We're over all of it. We're over, like, going to work to, like, sell our time and our energy for, like, a couple of bucks. We're over, like, living in this way that, like, feels totally out of balance. We're over being isolated. We're over, like, we're just, like, fucking over it. And then, like, we know that there's another way, right? Like, we know it. And now it's just a matter of being, like, point A to point B. It's kind of like how when I, like, felt that story come, right? Like, I had the first line, and I had the last line, and then you have to connect the points. Like, I feel like we have the first line now. We have, like, even some of the chapters, and then we have the last line, but, like, who's going to write those chapters that are missing now? Like
the middle ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And if we're all going to write those together, like, what does that look like? And like, the publisher is like really breathing down our necks now, because like, we got to get this book out. So what do we do now?
Yeah.
I feel like 20 years ago when I started, like, if you want to call it rewilding or like getting into that idea, like, it was still like a little bit like out there, like, oh, what are we going to do? Like, maybe civilization's a problem. And it was like those things were like kind of theoretical. Like, now everybody's just like, civilization is the problem. Like, yeah. I don't want to sell my hour for like a dollar. Like, and I do feel like the younger generations are just like amazing with this. Like, they're just like, we've had it. There's no future for us here. But like, what is that? What are those missing chapters going to be? Like, what's the next?
It's good. I love that as a bookworm. I love the metaphor that you've used there with your book. And yeah, I like the community approach you took as well. But yeah, you got to try and figure out how to make those people held accountable for. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a question now. And, you know, you obviously can't say much.
No, yeah.
Which is another reason, truth be told, why I love writing fiction. Because it's like storytelling is a way, like storytelling is very important for those reasons of like questioning status quo and paradigms in cultures and then exploring other options, but safely. Mm.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
Tell each other stories. We can sit here and tell each other stories all night. I can tell you a story about how, just down the road, Farmer John told me that all the cornfields that we use to create gasoline now, right, that we mix to make petroleum products, like all those cornfields are just sitting out there. This is what Farmer John told me. All these cornfields are just sitting out there, no lock and key on them. They're just out there all over the world, wherever you're growing corn, right? And I can say, and Farmer John said, I don't want to be some sort of curmudgeon, but they're just sitting out there, right? Like, Farmer John's just, like, this silly old guy.
Yeah.
And I could tell you about Farmer John all night and all Farmer John's ideas.
Yeah.
And we could explore those stories, and we could, like, laugh, and we could be like, oh, that's so silly, or like, that's a horrible idea, like, oh, silly Farmer John and his, like, wife Susie or whatever. And those could be, like, totally fictional characters. And, like, it's funny because we can explore ideas for things that actually could be useful, but it's also just like really important practice, like culturally and as humans and as people, to find a way to explore scary ideas in a way that's safe. Like, that's how we grow, that's how we move forward, that's why stories have always been important to us, like, as a species, and I do believe to every species, because like it's like how we look at those fears in a safe way.
Yeah, it's like exploring the options in a manageable and safe way, and out of curiosity and maybe possibly sparking interest somewhere. Yeah,
no, yeah. I like that. Why do we love reading? Like, I totally feel that on the like bookworm, the bookish bookworm thing. It's like, well, I love it because it like allows me to look at a million different worlds and think of a million different things.
Mm.
Like, I'm not necessarily going to like run out and try to like, you know, do any of the things I read in those books, but like they really help me push my own like edges.
And yeah.
Like, I think we have to get really comfortable doing that now. Like, those of us who want things to move and to change, and we're like, okay, we need those missing chapters. Like, we have to get like really comfy in the storytelling space, and we have to explore those scary things in that space because that's protective for us. And then we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I like that. It's a good answer. I think I heard you voicing these, yes, similar to these thoughts when you and Peter Michael Ballett interviewed each other. I love those combined interviews, by the way.
I'm so glad you like them.
So, and in the same episode, you guys chatted about trans people in Indigenous societies, and this is the fourth year I've been doing this podcast, and the only negative feedback I've received quite a few times has been from listeners who view me as erasing women when I'm being inclusive to trans people.
Mm.
Now, I think a lot of people in Western civilization or Western society, they don't realize that being trans is not some sort of new invention. So I wonder if, what could you share about, share with us about trans people in Indigenous societies or other cultures? Like, what is your knowledge here?
Yeah, so I have been thinking about this a little bit lately because I feel really thankful that, like, I'm 39, right? So, and I've just been thinking about this in terms a lot of, like, my own relationship, like, with my body or, like, how I look and, like, how that's changed over time. And I feel, like, so thankful that the way the current conversation is happening and like how many people have put their literal necks and bodies, like, and hearts and souls on the line to like educate everybody about the fact that like we don't exist in like a binary model. But I feel like I've really started to love like that idea, and that I think like what our Western civilization wants us to do is to like make everything binary. Like, it's this or it's that. it's black or it's white. Like, I like reading or I like sports. Like, even just the most, like, stupid, basic, like, ideas. Like, I like Coke or I like Pepsi. Like, I like, like, just they, everything has to be binary because, like, that's how you, or that's how you get, that's how you, like, control somebody. Like, they, everything has to be binary because, like, then, like, you will buy products. Everything has to be binary because, like, that's how things fit together. But like, that's not true of anything. Nothing is binary. Like, I can love, like, the most ridiculous example, like, I can love Coke and Pepsi and Sprite, and then also, what? Like, maybe one day I'll want to drink Sprite and then, like, 3 months later I'll drink Pepsi, and I'll like them equally. But it's like that expanded times everything forever. So
yeah,
like, I think that like, obviously, and again, I can't speak for Indigenous cultures, but like, from what I know of like, Indigenous wisdom and like, again, some of those qualities that, like, come through from different cultures and sort of have a commonality is that and I can sort of, like, interject my own experience reconnecting with the natural world here is like nothing in the natural world is binary. Like, everything is constantly changing and going through cycles and is fluctuating. And like, you can even look at ecology as an example. Like, say you look, you talk, you look at say you're looking at like a little pond, right? Like, the little ponds you probably have them in New Zealand too, that, like, form in the springtime when snow melts, and then they're, like, only there for a little while, and then, like, they'll get some little, like, frogs, like tadpoles and frogs in there, and then, but then, like, maybe eventually that completely dries up, and, like, maybe some of the tadpoles die, and then, like, some other plant grows there because now it's, like, more fertile. I mean, what in that ecosystem is, like, either or? Nothing. Like, everything is in flux. Everything is, like, constantly interacting in a relationship with everything else. And, like, from one year to the next, it can be totally different. Some years that pond, like, might not even show up. Some years, like, there might be a proliferation of frogs. Some years, maybe it'll be there, like, all year round some years. And, like, sometimes you can ice skate on it in the winter. So, okay, that's, like, one example of one tiny little ecosystem, and then just, like, expand that times everything forever. Yeah. There's, like, no binary anywhere. Like, of course there's no binary in, like, how we feel about ourselves or how we feel about the people that we love or any of it. Like, it's, that's a total nonsense construct, like, modern construct that, like, just needs to be, like, totally trashed by the wayside. Like, it doesn't even work for Coke and Pepsi. Like, it's not going to work for, like, gender or how we feel about ourselves or, like, anything else.
Yeah. I like that. That's a really good answer. And I guess it would also, the same would apply for anybody who identifies as anything other than heterosexual. It's the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Now, when I reached out about doing this interview, I asked if there was anything you would like to discuss. And you have your son, Revel, and also
Xander.
So do you homeschool both of them?
I do, yeah. We homeschool both of them. This will be our third year going into this next year. We did start homeschooling once COVID shut the schools here. And then for, like, the first month, Xander was still in public school. And so he had to do, like, the online programs that they were suggesting or, like, giving the kids after the schools closed. And, like, we just all hated it so much. Like, we almost just, like, died about it. So, but then it really, like, unclicked us from the school system. Cause I actually originally went to school for secondary English when I was in college. So I was, like, have been in the education system. I mean, I went to public school, then I did that for part of college. Then I ended up teaching in the Waldorf school, which is, like, a different paradigm, but it's still, like, a school, you know, and they have a very, very structured and specific approach. So, I mean, I will be the first to say, like, I totally didn't realize it. And I've been, like, working on rewilding my brain and my body and everything for so long. And I, like, was totally indoctrinated in the school system still, like, to the last moment. To this year, even still, like, approaching it, like, okay, in the beginning of the year, being like, I'm going to make these lessons. And I've, like, got my whiteboards. And then, like, I'm going to have them sit down at the table. And then, like, we did that three times. And, like, everything was miserable. And it was so boring. And I was like, what is happening? Like, why am I doing this? And then we found the best homeschool community that we could have found around here, which is, like super outdoorsy, like, just, like, wild, little wild children.
Cool.
And, like, families that love, you know, the environment. And then that, like, shifted everything for me. And then I started learning more about, like, unschooling and radical unschooling and how people actually learn. And so that's been, like, a really exciting adventure for me currently. And I feel really, really super, like, excited and passionate about it because, like, that was the place where I really, really needed the work, like, on my own indoctrination. And I'm, like, really thankful that I'm able to do that and, like, unpack some of that.
It's like you need to de-school yourself to...
Like, I absolutely so was like, okay, like, I'm going to make a school, like, in our kitchen. And I know, like, I guess that does work for some people, but, like, no, it wasn't working for us.
Now, because you told me that you're helping to run a nature immersion program for unschoolers or homeschoolers. Is this the group that you're talking about?
We run a nature immersion program for kids ages 4 and up. It's called Skyline Community School. We end up working with a lot of homeschool families and then also, like, preschool age children, like, before they go to school. And then also in the States right now, like, hybrid schooling is pretty popular. So, like, kids that learn online or, like, do online programs or that kind of thing. So we are going to be in, like, so far we've been using local parks. There's a state park pretty nearby that we'll probably use some of the time next year, or that we'll use that as our sort of, like, home base. But I feel like just getting the chance to see how kids behave when you actually give them the space to explore and, like, give them the resources that they are asking for or needing, but, like, really just let them go, like, it's so beautiful. It just happens, and it's showed me so much, because, like, I feel this way about like, I worked in ecological landscaping for a long time, and I feel like what I've learned from this, like, unschooling journey is really similar to what I have experienced with the idea of, like, landscaping or like, ecological conservation kind of stuff. Is, like, we force everything. Like, we force it. We want to create a container, and then we want to, like, design how everything's going to function within the container. And then we, like, want that to work. So, like, that could be school, that could be public school, that could be homeschool, right? Like, we, like, have this idea, we make a container, we're like, everybody get into this container, and we're going to force this outcome. We're going to force, like, the last line. Like, like, instead of being like, here's the first line, here's the last line, let's see what happens. It's like, I know every single line in between. And then that's really what I found with the, like, ecology work too, and the conservation work, is, like, that is very much along the same line. So, like, you're making this design, you're planning this design, and then, you know, you're going from point A to point B, and you're putting, like, every plant where it's supposed to go. And then at the end, you're, like, hoping for this outcome, which, like, it doesn't, like, you can't get to the outcome that you want because the process is, like, all wrong. Like, it's too. So, but then I've actually, like, after trying all these things and even, like, really being into the idea of, like, we can design, like, a new landscape, like, we can fix the ecosystem by, like, doing it ourselves, like, we can fix it, but, like, I don't think that that's how it will work or how it works. I think that it's actually more about us just like taking our hands off of the project, like whether that be the child that's you're raising or that's growing, or whether that be your backyard that you're wanting to rewild and like bring native plants into. Like, it's not so much about like what we're doing at this point. It's a lot about not doing, like undoing, like just not doing. Yeah. So like you just let the child grow, or you just let, you stop mowing your yard and then you just like let it go. And that's like all it is. Like the revolution, or like the what happens next, I honestly feel like is the paradigm flip is just like stopping.
Yeah.
Like you're making it more complicated than what it is.
Yeah.
Just it's a stopping. Like stop mowing. Mm. And then you know what? Just let it go. Something's gonna grow there. It's like, okay, well, I want my kid to learn math. Well, like, just, like, leave your kid alone, and eventually you'll find something. I mean, don't leave them alone, but, like don't force math on them. But give them a world where things are interesting, and, like, maybe they'll want to figure out how many inches they need to make something to build something, or they have to buy something. And then just, like, take your hands off, and they'll figure it out. Like, it's a... it's like the opposite of the way we're living. Like if we're always doing, we just have to like start undoing.
Yeah, we're like, yeah, like you said, we're complicating things. We're trying to control things, and we really just need to do the opposite of that.
I truly feel it. And really, it was like the landscaping, the ecological landscaping, really, really started to show me like, and that people. I mean, it's wonderful. Like people have the best intentions of like. Like I want you to come and make a design for me, and I want to rewild my, you know, my acreage or whatever, and I want it to be this. And then I was like really caught up in that for like a good while, and I was like, we can do this, like we can like make these habitats and we can like build these things. And it does help sometimes, like sometimes you bring the natives in and they just like really take off because they are meant to be there, and you know, they evolved with that ecosystem, and you don't have to water them as much and that kind of thing. But then sometimes it doesn't work at all. Like sometimes you've entirely ignored the idea of succession. You've ignored the idea that like certain plants come in regardless of where they originated, because like the soil's able to maintain those plants in that space for that time. And like they're there to like build up the soil so other things can grow. Like, so like sometimes those plants just like don't work. Sometimes like the plants don't do well. And then I feel like there's this feeling of like, well, but if I have good intentions and I like want to plant plants where like butterflies will come to my yard, like it should work out. But like there's just like so much more that we don't know. Like we can't control everything. Like we just be a part of it. Like how we've always just been a part of it. Like we're not, we don't own it. Like we don't control it.
I love this ecological thread that you've like woven into all the answers, like all the different topics we've talked about, whether that's what like unschooling or trans people or grief. It's I love it. It's really good.
Yeah, really we're part of the ecosystem, like at very basic, like you would never describe a wolf, like if you were like, please tell me what a wolf is. Like, I feel like I couldn't describe a wolf to you without saying something about where a wolf lives or, like, what it eats or, like, something about it. Right?
Yeah.
Or, like, try to describe, like, a snail. Like, without describing where, like, you put it, because you would be like, okay, well, it has, like, a really cute little, like, curly shell and it's, like, really wet. But then if you didn't tell me that a snail had to live somewhere that was, like, pretty moist, like you're leaving out a huge part of what a snail is, because like maybe I'm picturing the snail as like very dry, but it's totally not a dry creature. So but I feel like we're only like, we only do that with us, where we'll like venture to describe ourselves completely and utterly separate from like the natural world that we're a part of. Like that's not how it works.
No, Oh, yeah, I love these analogies you're able to come up with, like, on the spur of the moment, like the snail and the wolf, and it's great. So your nature immersion program, like, how frequently do you guys meet?
We are 2 days a week right now, and we have been doing, like, a summer day every 2 weeks or so. So, like, we can get together and play and splash in the water and whatnot. Yeah, and we've connected with a couple of other groups that are doing, like, similar ideas near us. So I kind of like that, like, as there's more and more of these, like, groups of nature immersion or, like, nature programs for kids, that there is this, like, network, like a web kind of growing.
Cool.
And, like, that feels really good. That feels, like, important that we connect with other people who are doing similar things. So, like, we actually are building a web, right? Like, we can visit each other. We could help each other with resources. We could.
You're building that community that you need. Yeah,
yeah. Like, you're really into community building. So that's pretty exciting.
It's good. And what's the number? Like, how many of you are there?
We had about 40 kids at the end of last year, and then people are still registering now for this year. So it's a pretty good size.
Cool.
And it's kind of growing all the time because there are so many people who are interested in getting their kids, like, you know, into these nature programs, which is, like, very encouraging. I'm so glad that people are, like, aware that that's a healthy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it mostly parents dropping off their kids?
Yeah, we do it so you can do mostly parents drop off. If you want to stay and help, like, you can. Or, like, if the help that you're, like, can bring to the table is, like, a good fit for, like, what everybody's needing, then, like, you can stay. A lot of parents do opt to just drop off because it's a little bit unusual to find, like, a homeschool program that you can drop off.
Yeah.
Or at least around here. So I feel like people like that idea.
Cool. Nice. Now, before I wrap things up, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, I'm very concerned with, like, the way things are going in the U.S. right now. I'm sure you've heard about the Roe versus Wade being overturned and just, like, some pretty, like, a trajectory that feels really, like, a little bit frightening. So that's, like, kind of a sobering thing happening right now. I do think that things are, like, polarizing more and more. So, like, as there are more and more of us who are, like, we're done with this, like, we're ready for something different. Of course, there will be that many people that feel that strongly that they want to keep the status quo as it is. So, like, I do feel like that's sort of, especially, like, here in the U.S. right now, just, like, really starting to heat up. So I'm curious, like, how that's that kind of, like, duality is, like, going to play out in a world where, like, we kind of said, like, there's no space for like, binary anything. Like, you can't live in a world where there's just, like, one, there's, like, two ideas. Like, there's a million ideas. So, but, like, I failed to see, like, how this is going to continue to operate, where, like, if these government systems are, like, well, you can be this or you can be this, or, like, this way or this way, like, it's not, like, the framework doesn't work out. So it's just going to continue to get more and more messy.
Yes, and I feel like I've interviewed two other people recently who have brought this up as well, and I mean, they're scared for what it means for the next, I don't know, for what's coming. It's like,
I guess I feel really heartbroken for, like, the activists that worked so hard, like, literally generations of women, and, you know, not just women, like, all different types of people worked to get to the point where women had, like, a fair amount of autonomy that, like, we have now or had more of a moment ago. And my heart really goes out to those people who, like, just, like, the generations of people that have done the work, like, just the fact that that can be wiped away so easily is, like, fairly heartbreaking.
Like, everybody's, well, not everybody, but, like, we're happy to go back It's like, why are we going backwards with these sort of ideas?
Yeah, it's like really disturbing. And I think, like, you know, as more of us are like, yeah, like we're ready to like move forward. We're ready to leave this stuff in the dust. And then there's like, it's just so easily turned the other direction. Mm. And it can feel really discouraging.
Yeah. Yeah, that is. Now, so I will put links in the show notes to your website and the Primal Anarchy website and your Instagram page. Is there anywhere else you recommend people to find out more about what we've talked about today?
No, I think that's perfect. I'm on Facebook. I just got onto Twitter, but I'm pretty terrible about posting on there. I have been working on setting up a Patreon site because I do have a little more work to do on rites of passage, and I'd really like to get that out into the world. So I'm working on kind of setting up a little, I don't know what you call it, a little Patreon thing.
Yeah.
So I can give you the link to that as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And that would be perfect. I'm terrible about like knowing websites and whatnot. So like, yeah, great. That's perfect that you're going to do that.
Okay, also, good.
If I've sounded distracted at any point, we have a 9-month-old Yorkie poo puppy that is like pretty much like just like attacking me through most of this because she really wants me to take her outside. So if I sound distracted, I've just been literally like wrestling with puppy for like most of this interview.
Well, because I've been watching you do it and I'm so impressed with how quiet she is. Like, our dogs would not be, she's barked what, like 3 times the whole time.
She's starting to get fussy.
Yeah. Well, Natasha, I'm so happy that we, you know, to have finally chatted with you and, you know, covered all these complex topics in one go. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your knowledge and thoughts and things with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Emily. I've absolutely loved talking to you. I feel like I hope we get to talk again.
Yes, yeah. So now my final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
One sentence. I would say, you are not alone.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.